Welcome to the Iron Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Roll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. Matt Moore, I've got you talking to me, so that means I am in your head and you have signs of weakness. How's it going?
Lance Stephenson is, you know, we thought after his initial dust up with the Heat when he was a bench player, we're like, oh no, like he's probably not going to go down that road again. I want to see Stephenson versus the Spurs. Like, I kind of want the Pacers to win only because I want to see what Stephenson would do to try and get in, like, to try and start trash talk with the Spurs. You're like, LeBron will talk back at you as much as he's like, I don't get involved in that. Like, no, he does. Like, he gets targeted by so many guys that he'll respond. I would like to see Stephenson versus the Spurs to see if he could kind of mess with them at all.
You know there's only one way that ends, right? That's with Popovich making him eat his own brain. Like it's Hannibal. I mean, that would be the only way for this to end.
don't talk about Hannibal to me because the season finale was the other night, and it was one of those episodes of television that I was standing negotiating with my television, trying to offer things like, "I'll be good, I promise. Don't do this." Like, that's how intense the episode was.
Wow.
I'm serious. I was like, "I'll do what you want. Like, just I'll write letters to make sure that you stay on the air. Don't do this. It doesn't have to be this way." But yeah, so you were in Miami for game three.
Yes.
I don't know. Everyone's kind of like, the Pacers are doomed. And I think that people did a pretty good job of overreacting less than usual throughout the course of these playoffs in terms of, well, it's a long series and we got to see what's going on. And then the conference finals have happened, and every game people are just super overreacting to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just because this is cliche, but the stakes are so high, right? I mean, you know, somebody asked Frank Vogel at Shootaround today, you know, is this the most important game of the season tonight? He's like, yeah, every game this time of year is the most important game of your season. And it's true. Like, you know, I think that, you know, it just breeds overreaction, but I am pretty impressed with the idea that, you know, I wonder if it's not believing, if people still don't believe in the Pacers, or if they just believe that Miami is that much better, or do they just not care about this series as much because everyone expects Miami to win after the you know, the months of the Pacers just kind of sucking and not being as focused as we wanted them to be. I mean, there's clearly something there that has lessened the reaction. But maybe this was just expected because they were so bad for 3.5 months.
Yeah, and I keep begging people to think about, ignore, and you have talked about this, ignore everything from February 1st through game one of the Wizards series.
Right.
Even the Wizards loss. Like, if you're just like, you'd be like, oh, well, that was disappointing for Indiana, but they'll get it back. And they did. And they won in six and didn't go seven. And then, you know, if you said even back in January, if you'd said, well, the Heat are going to be up 2-1 going into game four at Miami, you'd be like, no, that sounds about right. Like, I got asked on radio about 7 times this week, is this series over?
I received the same questions.
And I'm like, but no, because one, there's two more wins that they have to get. And two, last year, the Pacers had game one in the bag. In the bag. Didn't play Roy Hibbert, and maybe Hibbert wouldn't have made a difference on that particular play, but didn't play Roy Hibbert final possession. LeBron gets the layup. Indiana went out and got the split anyway. Like, Indiana split game one and two in Miami last year, and then the Heat split games three and four in Indiana last year. You know, and maybe they'll win tonight. And 3-1, even with home court, is basically done. But I just don't see why there's such a drive to be like, well, this thing's done. And we did the same thing with Oklahoma City, San Antonio. I did that because I didn't think Ibaka was going to play. I was like, well, this is done. Like, the Spurs are just too good without Ibaka. And then Ibaka played. And now I'm like, well, this ain't done. We got more basketball to play here.
Yeah, I mean, I think Indiana's goal throughout all this is obviously to win 4 games in the series. But their goal is to come away from the first 4 games with a 2-2 split, right?
Yeah. Because you want to make it a 3, you know, and you could say, well, their goal should be to win every game. Well, yeah, it is. But realistically speaking, you know the Heat are going to win 2. Your goal needs to be make it a 3-game series in which you have home court advantage.
Right. And it is, I mean, if they do go down 3-1, I would say it's over. And not, you know, that's not discounting the Pacers as much as it's, I think the Heat are like 8-0 when they go in game fives when they go up 3-1. I think I saw that stat today. Maybe I'm making that up, but I'm pretty sure that's a stat I saw. Like, they just close out 3-1 leads. And there's no real reason to think the Pacers would be any different, although they would have home court advantage, in, or, you know, at least for game five. But yeah, as we've talked about before in this playoffs, like, I don't know that home court advantage means anything. Especially,
yeah, they're especially not good at home.
Right,
so.
Especially this late in the season. Like, I mean, home court is just, you have the four best teams in the league, in theory. And I believe it's pretty much the four best teams in the league anyway. And so when you have that kind of parity, you know, there's not a lot of advantage anymore. It's just who ends up executing the best.
And if you tell Miami, like, you got to win one, all you got to do is win one, then that gear comes up. Manu had a fascinating answer last night, or this morning, talking about, they asked him, how does a team that wins this many games, that is this good, in the conference finals, simply not come out with effort? And he said, and James shared this with us on the campfire, it's the mystery of the human head.
It is.
But it's fascinating because both Indiana and Miami remind me of this in that, as we've said many times before, Miami especially, but Indiana's the same way. They don't respond unless they absolutely, positively have to. When they absolutely have to, they respond. You know, and realistically in game three, like, Miami going down 2-1 to Indiana with Indiana having home court advantage, that's not good.
Right.
You know, even with, you say, well, we know we can win there, it's still not preferable. Like, it's still not good. I want to see, you know, Indiana hadn't lost back-to-back games in the playoffs until game three. So I'm really curious to see if they do, in fact, go down 3-1. It's a interesting thing. It's also weird because, and this is in the, both series have some similarities now, in that on one side you can say the Thunder and Heat's defense create havoc with their athleticism, which forces turnovers. And on the other side you can say if the Spurs and Pacers just take care of the ball, they can win. And finding the balance between those two principles, to me, determines a lot of both of these series.
Yeah, I mean, that you're at such a point in the season with such great talent on the court that any mistake, and especially any mistake that's capitalized, it's just death, right? I mean, you can't. These teams are too good to where you can't afford many mental errors. And when they come, we see that kind of like, as Keanu Reeves talks about in The Replacements, it's that quicksand effect, right? It's one thing goes wrong, and then another, and then another, and then another, and then all of a sudden Ray Allen's hit four threes in your face. No, not in your face, because nobody was guarding him. He's hit four threes in the fourth quarter, and all of a sudden you're down 12, and you're like, where did this come from? And it is that quicksand effect, and that's what, you know, I draw all of my sports analysis from Keanu Reeves movies. I think that it's just, that's the thing of like, You know, one begets another, begets another, begets another, it becomes such a hole you have to, you know, crawl out of, and it's just it becomes too hard this late in the game.
What should the Pacers do with Evan Turner? Shoot the hostage.
Yes. send him to the safe house that is obviously rigged to explode.
That's the answer there. It's also perplexing to me because people act like, God, they're just, why do they play so stupid? They just turn the ball over. I'm like, do you understand how hard this is at this level? Like, George Hill is running side pick and rolls, going to the wing, getting cut off at the corner by Udonis Haslem, with Dwayne Wade diving in for the ball. And meanwhile, he's going to make a jump pass over himself, either to reverse court with LeBron James lurking weak side or Chris Bosh fronting his man in the post. Like, that's like, this is the difference in the playoffs versus the regular season. Because in the regular season, it's like, no, you can throw the ball in the post. That's fine. Like, that's okay. We'll pretty much let that. Like, they let guys have stuff in the regular season, and now every pass you have to work for in these games.
And that's really the key with, you know, maybe the Pacers in this series is finding ways not to go sideways when they're running pick and rolls.
Yeah.
Because that I mean, that's really the thing. Like, they're not making any progress. They're just, if anything, they're cutting off the court for themselves. And then Miami, you know, Miami puts you in a trap, and they're rotating their head, you know, they're playing the passing lanes, and there's just too much that can go wrong when you're you know, moving sideways. And I mean, even moving backwards in this situation would be better, because you then have more of the floor to observe, right? And not that you want to keep moving backwards as you run a pick and roll, but it's just so much better than finding yourself against two defenders and the sideline.
They need to run college ball. Just pass it around the perimeter like six times.
They should watch Hoosiers. Five passes.
I was actually talking about that, and this isn't a name drop because I wasn't – like I was not corrected, but my viewpoint was adjusted by Brent Berry. Talking with Zach Lowe and Brent Berry on Twitter about this, about – I was talking about how the they can't reverse court. Like, they just – the Pacers right now cannot reverse court. They're so terrified of throwing the ball reversal pass that – because it's going to get picked off and taken the other way by Cole or LeBron or whoever, that they're trying to run everything, like you said, on one side of the floor. And if you tell the Heat, three of you have to defend like 10 feet, you're dead. You have to create space. And without that, you're in real trouble. And Barry said, well, why are they even going inside anyway? Basically, like, they've got to get to the middle. And that's a lot of it. Whether they're running it or George Hill is electing to use it that way, they're running a lot of stuff on those wing pick and rolls, those side pick and rolls. The Thunder have done the same thing. KD keeps getting trapped in corners because he keeps pushing himself to the baseline, and I don't know what it is that he thinks is going to open up there, but it's not coming. He's got to stay with the basket in front of him to give him space to move laterally. The Spurs have done a great job kind of basically quartering the floor against Westbrook and Durant, saying, well, you're athletic, and that's awesome. You only have X amount of space to move.
Right.
And that's causing, I think, a lot of problems.
And to a certain degree, like, you know, last game, in the really last two games, the Heat's role players have stepped up and the Pacers haven't. I mean, Norris Cole played. Jeff Zilgit of USA Today has a great article today about how Norris Cole switching onto Lance Stephenson at the end of Game Two, and then then working some of that in Game Three was a great adjustment, and it was. And so Norris Cole did that. He also attacked the basket in Game Three and got some layups at the end of possessions, and which really, if you can get that against this Pacers defense, you get these really good layup attempts. That's a little deflating for them because they're the team that protects the paint better than anybody. And so it's that, it's Birdman stepping up in Game Two and having a positive impact. It's Ray Allen hitting threes in Game Three, you know, in the fourth quarter. Like, and who stepped up for the Pacers? Like, Scola was okay in what, Game Three?
Yeah.
You know, CJ Watson hasn't been terrible, but who, like, which player is stepping up outside of that starting unit? And even that entire starting unit isn't stepping up at times. So, it, you know, sometimes it's just as simple as our role players played better than your role players.
If there was one thing that you would say the Pacers need to do in Game Four, what would they say they need to do?
Trade Evan Turner.
Let's say there's two.
Okay. I think they have to punish the Heat when they go small. You know, and they talked about how they got away from that in game three. And, you know, at a certain point, if LeBron is guarding David West, why are you not posting up David West every time? I know LeBron can grab some, you know, can force some turnovers, but you have to punish LeBron. As strong as he is, as great as he is, you have to punish him with David West inside. You have to punish Chris Bosh. You have to punish Udonis Haslem. You have to punish, you know, Chris Anderson. Like, these are all fine defenders. These are all really good defenders. But you have to punish them with your size advantage. Otherwise, what's the point of having a size advantage?
I wonder how much of this is, you know, because we've had this kind of throughout the playoffs. It's been kind of quiet, but the Pacers' bigs get pissed when they don't get the ball. Like, yeah. they get pissed. And, like, you've got to get me the ball. And I can just imagine the Pacers' guards being like, you've got to get open. Like, we're getting killed because of turnovers. I can't throw the ball in if you don't have position. West, it's a little bit different. Part of the thing is that they're doing a great job of – West is big and he's powerful, but he's not long. So if you're able to contest and basically make them afraid of the reach around steal, so to speak, West will continuously push himself out, and then he's getting the ball face up at like 18, and he's not really gonna. You want him having to cover more space because it exhausts him more at this point in his career. As long as you guard that mid range jumper, he's still able to kill you that way. But they're doing a good job, I think, of basically making it really difficult to make that entry pass. And this has been something that they look like they've fixed. I'm asking this question over and over. They did such great work basically running pick and roll, and the screener rolls into the post. That is, to me, the best thing that they can do. And they once again have gone away from it. They did it a little bit in game one, and it worked. And they've once again gone away from it. And I don't understand why they don't consistently go to that. And I understand that that's that side pick and roll action, but you've got to at some point at least put another guy on that wing. I don't know. You've got to get some way to be able to get the ball down there, because when you have a mismatch out of the switch, you've got to be able to take advantage of that, especially, like you said, if they're small.
Yeah, and maybe this is too simplistic of an adjustment, but I mean, wouldn't you just run a pick and roll with Roy Hibbert, have him flash to the post as David West is coming to the free throw line? Because then you have a high-low action. I mean, I know it's not that simple. I know Miami can, you know, figure out how to cover that, but you're at least throwing different looks in there. You're throwing, you know, you're throwing some extra movement, and that's really the key, is that the Pacers just end up having zero movement. And you know, when they were so good in game one, and they were so good at the end of that Wizards series, it's because they were moving around. You had David West throwing passes everywhere to guys moving. I mean, you had Lance Stephenson picking the defense apart. Like, you just get this off-ball movement. You get, you know, you get the defense moving side to side, and that's where the breakdowns happen. And not side to side of you dribbling to the sideline because you can't turn the corner on a pick and roll. And maybe it's as simple as, you know, that flash to the middle. You get West the ball. And then you've got, you know, you theoretically have two guys in the corner. You've got Hibbert getting position. I mean, the key to that is obviously Hibbert being able to get deep position.
Yeah.
Or maybe you reverse them and you have David West do that with Hibbert flashing to the middle, which isn't as ideal because he's not as good of a passer as West, but you know, maybe that's something.
They ran that in game one. It was one of the plays, like, I really noticed was they did a remarkable job of use West as the screener, and when they trap, they get the ball to West, because West can either take the short jumper or then pass to Hibbert. The problem was, after game one, in game three, they ran the exact same play late, and Wade, instead of hesitating like LeBron did, Wade just absolutely blitzed Hibbert, came over around him and got the steal.
Yeah, he blew it up, and that's where you have to, you know, I agree with you on the post players needing to get open and getting good position in order to make that pass a likelihood, but the passers still have to be cognizant of where the help is.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, and I mean, think about how far we're down the rabbit hole here, right? Like, you've got to execute the screen correctly. You've got to be able to get the pass past the double. You've got to be able to then make the right decision on whether to shoot or pass. Then you've got to make the correct pass and make sure it goes to the right side so that it doesn't get picked off by these insane athletes. This is the margin of error when you get to this level of play.
It's almost like NBA basketball is really hard.
Not according to many people online, because if I get one more person acting like this is all about the Pacers and Thunder sucking, I'm going to go nuts. I'm like, do you own it? Like, they're in the conference finals. Like, you can't really say that this season was a failure no matter what. The Thunder's goal is to win the title every year. The Pacers' goal is to win the title. All four of these teams had serious championship aspirations when the season began. If you make final – and it, I almost want to – it's one area maybe we should be more like college. Like, in college, if you make a Final Four, it's like, oh, what a great job. Look at me, Final Fours he's made. And in the NBA, it's like, oh, you lost in the conference finals? You suck. Like –
yeah, but to be fair, in college they play defense, and by defense I mean they've no more than three guys on both teams combined on the floor at any time can dribble.
Right.
I guess I can understand why you would think the Pacers aren't that good, right? Like, there are some serious flaws in their construction of the roster, in the sense of there aren't a lot of playmakers who can dribble the ball, and so I guess I can understand that, but. With the Thunder, they've dominated this matchup for 2 years. And they're missing, you know, their best defender and one of the best defenders in the league. And where, I mean, yes, they played horrible offense in game two, but for the most part, they're getting destroyed on defense. I feel like that's not a, this team sucks. It's a, wow, they're missing a key player, which we saw in game three. I mean, Serge, I didn't think Serge played all that well on defense, but he was effective. He was in position. You know, he didn't have much leaping ability, but he did block, what, three or four shots? I mean, he was effective, but he was effective while not really looking like Serge Ibaka.
When they tested him early, this is what was big, is he's got an injury, so they tested him, and Parker got in the paint, and Ibaka had a great block on him to force the jump ball. Like, just a great job. And after that happened, after he made a few of those plays, it got in their heads. Like, this is a thing that's been, like, huge for me. Iguodala first told me about it, and then I started talking to other guys, and everyone, like, the impact of it. Because I was always like, well, shot blocking, typically it's a risk that it can actually hurt your defense, and is it really overrated? And all the guards I've talked to were like, nope, because I'm terrified of going in and getting, one, knocked unconscious, and two, my shot blocked into oblivion. Like,
that is something I agree with you. Like, that's something where I always thought, like, oh, the shot block out of bounds is just so stupid. It's so unnecessary, blah, blah, blah. And then I was at a Magic Celtics game in, like, God, I don't know, 2008 or 2009. It was one of those. And Dwight Howard, early in the game, like, swats a shot in, like, the third or fourth row. And then after that, like, they just didn't really attack him all that hard. And that was, like, seeing that in person and kind of seeing the adjustment in body language, it was like, all right, no, it's not the smartest play. But it does have an effect. It, legitimately has an effect. Guys don't like to be embarrassed like that.
And the problem with San Antonio is they basically were like, well, we can't go in there because Serge is in there, so let's totally adjust our game. And like, no, you have to keep going at him. You have to be like, your hamstring is hurting. You have to jump up and down every single play. We're going to keep going at you every single time. But to his credit, he just gave a phenomenal effort, and that boosted the team, and they played much better. I just can't really fathom, like – I mean, people seriously think Scott Brooks is a terrible coach. Like, they think he is an awful coach.
Look, I don't think he has a great offensive system. I don't think he makes great in-game adjustments. But that team is prepared to play every dime, and it's not just oh, we have Durant and Westbrook, like we're okay to play. Like, it clearly takes more than that. And I, you know, maybe he's not the coach that gets them to the championship aspirations that they need, but he's a coach that can get you very close.
Yeah, and I'd say that he makes tremendous in-series adjustments. I've never seen him coach a series where the Thunder didn't get better by the end of the series than they were at the beginning. And if you say that that's common, it's not. Like, there's a lot of guys that they don't do well making adjustments the longer a series goes. There's a lot of guys.
Like, I think that. You could maybe – I mean, maybe this is overly critical, or maybe this is too soon to really know, but you might be able to say that about Frank Vogel. I don't know that Frank Vogel makes great in-series adjustments. I think he's a good in-game adjuster. But I don't know that he, from one game to the next, that he has a lot of variation. I guess we'll see tonight.
This is going to be sacrilege. I'd argue Popovich has a similar issue. Series go long with San Antonio, and they struggle. Like,
yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe with him, it's the system is so good, and eventually you know it should win out. And so it's stick with what we have, and you just trust that that's going to eventually be enough. And, you know, it has been quite a bit. But, yeah, I think that's maybe something to explore. I don't know that I agree, but I don't know that I disagree either.
Right. Although it's hard for me to defend Scott Brooks when the Thunder ran a Perkins ISO in the first quarter last night. That was
amazing.
He got the ball, and I was like, you're really going to do this? Like.
And that was the thing where I tweeted something like, you know, obviously we didn't know any better early on in his career, but when was the last time you felt good about a Kendrick Perkins shot? And I got a lot of, oh, the game tire against Memphis. And it's like, well, that's a reaction thing. Like, I'm talking about, like, running a post up for him.
Right.
Like, getting him a shot. Like, what? Like, it would have to have been pre-KG. In Boston.
I really want to see what they look like when he's gone. Like, I want to know if there's a difference. Like, if there's a definite shift in either attitude or performance And if, you know, I could see a scenario in which they're not, they have a down season after he's gone, and then they ask, like, what's different? And the players actually say, well, we really miss Perk. Like, I could see that happening. As much as everyone does not understand why he plays, they have a confidence in him and a love for him that does resonate very deeply.
Unless it comes to taking team pictures, and then he's nowhere to be found.
Nowhere to be found.
What did you think? I mean, I started trying to draw parallels between Game 3 of the 2012 Western Conference Finals between these two teams and then Game 3 of last night, and there were some, like, eerie similarities where they almost shot an identical percentage. The Spurs almost shot an identical percentage and almost had an identical number of shots blocked, which doesn't ultimately mean anything, but it was, you know, in 2012, the Thunder kind of turned it around more in Game 2, but they really turned it around in Game 3 and ended up figuring out how to dominate that matchup. And then last night, they get Serge back. They put Reggie Jackson in the starting lineup. You know, Thabo doesn't play. Nick Collison doesn't play. There is something to be said of, like, you can see them possibly turning the corner in this matchup once again.
I'm at a point where I believed all season long that the Thunder were better. And then I looked at a lot of numbers before this matchup. And, you know, I did, like, talked about it on the podcast before the series started, before we knew Ibaka was out. And I came out thinking that San Antonio just had a little bit more of an edge. They just had a tiny, tiny fraction of an edge. And that obviously got exacerbated by Ibaka. I continue to see things that the Thunder do which are sustainably good. And this will drive everyone nuts. I don't find Manu Ginobili's performance to be sustainably good. And if you want to say, how long does he need to do it for? I'm going to say he needs to do it for an entire six-game series against the Oklahoma City Thunder. That's where I got to see it. Because, you know, him shooting, like, knocking down everything, to me, there's going to be some sort of fallback because he's no longer a player that takes over like this. He took over in the regular season at times, but then there'd be games where he was completely absent. I hammer this, I'll keep going back to it. It is harder to be consistently great at his age than it is to be individually, singularly good. Like, Kendrick Perkins can't have a good night, you know? Like,
right. Well, he just doesn't have the basketball skill for it.
Right. Manu Ginobili can have several great nights, but eventually there's a cost. And I wonder how much the Spurs are depending on that to carry them.
Well, I think the big key with last night was Manu could keep them close, but the fact that Manu was that good and Tony Parker was awful. I mean, Tony Parker was terrible, I thought.
You need,
as much as we say, like, oh, you can plug any player into the Spurs system, and if they buy in, they're going to be fine, you still need the top guys to consistently perform. And you can have, you know, you can have one or the other and maybe balance it out a little bit, but maybe not at this stage in the season. So I think Manu is sustainable as long as Tony Parker improves.
I'm interested in Game 4 is kind of the answer I keep coming to, which, because that one really does change it. Like, everything changes in Game 4. Either, well, the Spurs gave them one, they had an off night in Game 3, but they took care of business, and now they really are the better team. Oklahoma City just doesn't have enough. Or, if the Spurs lose 2 after winning 2, and this follows the exact same pattern of 2012, as much as they talk about, we don't get affected by this stuff, we're a veteran team, blah, 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 collars are going to get tight. There's going to be a, uh-oh. Like, that's going to be a legitimate whelp moment for them if they lose game four. Because now all of a sudden the Thunder have all the momentum. They're not afraid of going and playing in San Antonio. They're going to start getting better performances from the guys that they need to get better performances from. And meanwhile, San Antonio kind of like they're going to have to rely on different things to carry them, and I think that gets tough.
I mean, I do agree. I agree with you in the sense of, like, they just went away from going at Serge Ibaka last night, and I would be going, you know, high low action or, you know, big to big action so much, trying to tire him out and trying to make Perkins be awful.
Tiago Splitter should get a ton of touches. What am I saying? But yes, like, Tiago Splitter should be getting a lot of looks, you know, and that's really, I think, a big part of the series, and they need to lean on him because he's not the player that he was in 2012. He's way better. They have guys on this team that are way better than they were in 2012. Those are the guys that they need to rely on. Kawhi Leonard, Tiago Splitter. Those are two guys that need to have bigger roles for this team and maybe not depend so much on Manu Ginobili running behind picks and taking three-pointers. They've gone down. I'm just saying you're going to want some sort of consistency.
Well, I think the Manu thing is you get him going, the defense overplays it, and then he picks you apart, right? I mean, yeah. I think that's the goal. So as long as they're hitting, that's fine. But if he hits his next one or two in game four, I think you'll see them trying to jump that, and then he'll be throwing behind the back passes through people's legs and
if Russell Westbrook plays off of him one more time, I'm gonna go insane. Like, I am a huge Westbrook supporter, but God, his tendency for wanting to steal, to go for the big home run steal, or to gamble is just ridiculous. Like, just we talk about this all the time. There was these guys, like, just face guard them. Like, don't let them shoot. If you take away Manu Ginobili's 3-point shooting, and if Tony Parker's having a bad game, their offense looks different.
Yeah, and back to the Pacers Heat series. Maybe don't cover Ray Allen with David West.
Right.
This doesn't work. It just doesn't.
Yeah, that was weird. I don't even know where that came from.
I mean, wasn't that the game one last year? Wasn't David West defending Ray Allen on that LeBron layup? And so he couldn't cheat off or something like that, and so you had no big man protecting. This isn't a new thing for the Pacers. Like, they keep thinking they have this matchup, and Ray's old. He's not going to run around that much. It's like, no, Ray still runs. Ray runs all the time.
It's crazy. He's thinking about retiring. Like, I don't know why he would, like. He could, he could make so much money next year. All he's got to do, I admire him for keeping things in perspective and not just being like, I can still play, I'm going to play. But
where Shane Battier is only thinking about retiring.
I love that. I love Shane Battier. Like, you can just tell every time Battier's matchup against a power forward, he's just like, six more games.
Yeah.
Six more games.
He's just counting. He's just crossing off days on the calendar.
Like, I'm almost done getting my face kicked in by this team, by having to cover these guys. Wow, Kawhi's defensive efficiency last night was 124.8.
Yay.
Splitter's was 141.3.
Jesus.
He only played 18 minutes, too.
Foul trouble?
Might have been.
Yeah, I can't remember.
When I rewatched it, I was a little bit there were conditions that were going on following a spirited game of True American.
Yeah, weather conditions.
Right, weather conditions.
Right. It was raining bourbon.
Speaking of things that sound like they're drunk.
Oh, man. So, things with the Grizzlies are interesting, I would say. They, Robert Parra is really starting to impact the league in a way that I find quite amusing.
Yeah, so Levian gets fired. Slash gets fired. Jaeger is going to interview with the Wolves. Jaeger interviews with the Wolves. He has a meeting with Glenn Taylor. It's going to happen. All they got to do is work out the logistics of the compensation, which were going to be complicated because Minnesota was like, you have zero leverage here.
Right.
Why are we possibly going to give you a first-round pick?
They didn't even want to give him a second-round pick. I mean, and they have three of them.
Right.
And they have no roster spots to carry a first-round pick and three second-round pick. Like, I mean, I guess they could have sold one, or they could have, stashed a guy in Europe, but like, it's not like they have the roster space to just absorb four roster spots from the draft.
Which, by the way, I would have taken the second rounder and ran if it was offered.
Any of those, because I think it's like 40, 44, and 53. Like, if they offer you 44, you have to take that.
Yep. But instead, he talks with Robert Parra on Sunday night.
Yeah.
The quote, I think, from Jaeger was, "Wow, he just gets me." Which, well, he almost got you out the door.
Several times.
So, and then, as I put it in the post that I wrote about this stuff, basically there's blood in the water. Once Levian got fired and the rumors about Jaeger came out, every NBA reporter started making calls. And there are quite a number of chatty Cathys involved in this scenario. And so now I've seen a Levian hit piece. I've seen Parra hit pieces. Independent of that, Chris Mannix of SI posted a story that basically outlines – it basically says Robert Parra is crazy. The player-coach suggestion – it's funny because everyone's freaking out about it. Chris Vernon said this on let's see, they fired Lash, I think, on Monday. On Tuesday, Chris Vernon in Memphis said he's batted around the idea of player coach Mike Miller. And we were all like, what? And then Vernon was like, I'm not saying he did it. He wanted to do it. I'm saying it was just disgust.
What's funny is the whole, like, Chris Wallace radio interview with Chris Vernon, where Chris Vernon is just like, you're reading off a piece of paper. Like, answer me. You're not answering the question. Like, you're just reading off a piece of paper. Like, that if you're Robert Pera, that you would say, all right, got rid of these guys. Chris Wallace, welcome back. By the way, need you to go do some media for me.
Yeah. Poor Chris Wallace. Chris Wallace is like, well, I haven't actually been in the office in a year.
You guys never updated my key.
Like, I had wondered what Wallace's role was because I never saw him around the facility when I was there for the Western Conference Finals last year, and no one ever talked about him. I knew he did radio, but I never heard that he – and then to actually hear, nope, I haven't really actually been in the building. I'm like, oh, no, this is not good. So now he's got to do the draft and run this team and do all this stuff in the interim, which they don't even know if they're going to keep him or Hollinger or what. And then on top of it, like – Pera floated the idea of Jaeger wearing a headset like an NFL head coach so he could get feedback from assistants or other people that wanted to give him information during a game. And I mean, said that that's much like a guy, the manager at Olive Garden on a busy Friday night.
Wouldn't Robert Pera know that there are assistants sitting, oh, I don't know, right next to the coach that can give him feedback?
Likes, that's the point. Is he wants influence from people that aren't Jaeger because he doesn't trust him or his staff.
Oh, my God.
So that's that idea. But now apparently everything's fine. Pera does a kind of – it was okay. It was just a kind of weird timing for a Twitter Q&A. He says, I'm willing to spend
– It was damage control.
Yeah.
I mean, it was absolutely – which is fine, but, like, there's no other way to spin that. Like, it was damage control.
And then he blows up on Mannix and says, wow, journalistic integrity. And basically, you know, why didn't you even contact me? I'm right here. And Mannix was like, well, I reached out to Grizzlies PR.
And then name-dropped the two guys to ask.
Which, by the way, Grizzlies PR is fantastic, but if you talk to literally any PR department, you say, I'd like to get in touch with the owner, the answer is always, sorry, yeah, he's real busy. That's not going to happen. And, like, it's almost instantaneous. Like, they don't even try and, like, fake it. Like,
yeah, they're not going to float the idea to the owner.
Right. Like, if you call them, they won't even be like, oh, hold on, let me put you on hold and check real quick. Like, they won't even do that. They're like, ooh, no, sorry, he's all booked up this week. You have his schedule in front of you? Yeah, just happen to have it. Sorry. Like, no chance. So now everyone's basically said, like, the word mess has been used, I think, 15 times. The word disaster a few times. Chaos, a popular one amongst NBA writers. That one's been used quite a bit. And it's being compared to Lacob. And then it gets compared to – by the way, I've also heard it compared to Sterling, which –
Let's not go that far.
Let's calm down a little bit on the Robert Pera's like that. Also, James Dolan, not really the same kind of deal. Like
at all. Like, all right, like, I think Robert Pera's being ridiculous right now, and I think he's being, you know, a crazy maniacal billionaire. But he's not going the way of the racist at all. In any way, this is not that. This is nothing like that. So that's a horrible comparison for people to make.
And also, I just got to say, don't compare this to the Lacob situation. Like, Joe Lacob has come across as a very reasonable, very business-oriented guy with a serious plan for how he wants the organization to be run. I understand everyone liked the preacher, but he didn't get along with people, and he's gone. That one decision does not constitute the kind of chaos that we've seen the last week in Memphis, where you've got two executives that were supposed to be running the team, a CEO, part owner, is gone. Coach was supposed to be gone, is now back with, and meanwhile you're entering, Zach Randolph's going to be a free agent, and Marc Gasol is entering a contract here. Like, this has serious ramifications. Joe Lacob fired a coach that was good, not great. There is a big difference there. I think having an owner that's engaged is good. I think having an owner that wants to reach out and be involved is a good thing. People forget that for a long time in the mid-2000s, one of the biggest problems in the NBA was that owners were basically removed. They didn't care. They would just kind of ran the teams. They would arbitrarily fire people because they were mad because they weren't winning, but they weren't involved in the day-to-day operations. Cuban changed that. Cuban showed that if you want to be great, you need to have a hand in your operations. Cuban trusted Donnie Nelson. That's what Paris. Do. He's got to find a guy or woman someone that he feels he can entrust running this team and doing reflecting what Para wants from this team. From an, as an organizational standpoint, you have to have strong leadership because this team can't make trades effectively. There's going to be questions about whether or not they're going to be able to draft effectively. They can't run that office effectively right now because no one knows who's in charge.
Right, and that's the thing, is that Para being involved isn't a bad thing. It's the way he's making it public, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's the public actions where Mark Cuban wasn't a saint publicly. I mean, he certainly, you know, made his presence felt early on in his ownership. But he did find a guy he trusted. He found a coach he trusted. And his input was always considered, but not necessarily like, this is what we're doing, guys, because I said so, because I own the team. And whereas Para, that's what it's, at least that from the stories, assuming they're mostly true, that's what it's coming off as.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I'll tell you, personally, as a guy that literally took the Grizzlies because I thought they'd be terrible, I'm a little bit comforted by this. This seems much more Grizzlies to me than all this success and sustainability and continuity. Total chaos and disaster makes a lot more sense to me. But I'm also not freaking out because part of me is like, what if they win 50 games next year? What if they re-sign Zach Randolph and win 50 games next year?
Like, well, right. They're not in a bad situation. They still have a very good core, a very good coach, I believe. And I think they're, you know, as long as the Zeebo stuff works itself out, I don't think Marc Gasol is going anywhere. You know, Mike Conley doesn't suffer, you know, some horrible injury. Like, they're fine. They're in a good position to be good. I mean, you know, Marc Gasol missed 23 games this year and they won 50 games. Like, that's a good team.
Of course, then there's the possibility of total chaos in the front office, the reverse course and fire Jaeger after saying he was going to be fine. Everything looks unstable. Zeebo says, I'm not going to be a part of this. This is nonsense. I'm too old for this S. Go somewhere else. And then Marc Gasol basically is in the same position of his brother as being like, yeah, it might be time for me to go elsewhere. And then he's in a contract year. They trade him, and then I cry tears of blood.
Either way, it's going to be exciting.
Either way, it's going to be exciting. You want to talk a little draft before we go?
Yeah, let's talk a little draft. Also, who do you have tonight's Heat-Pacers game?
I took the Pacers. I took them in game two, though, or game three as well, though. So, I don't know. Every time I picked against the Pacers, they've won. Every time I picked them, they've lost. So, good news, Heat fans. They're probably heading for a win tonight. I think the Pacers, I think it's especially because this is the second time it's Heat minus six. It opened at seven. I can't take a line that big with these two teams. Just can't do it.
Yeah, that does seem like a lot of points. I would take the Pacers to cover, but I think the Heat win.
Okay, they covered game three, so I was wrong on that. But still, I think the safer bet is to kind of trust it's going to be tighter than that. Okay, so how about Embiid? Let's talk Embiid. Because the consensus is coming out that he's the number one guy, and there's two conflicting kind of patterns of thought. One is, I saw him in a workout. He looks great. He looks super mobile. Like, he's definitely the most skilled guy. I don't know how you don't take him number one. And then there's a smattering, say, of people, of which I am one, that say, until he takes an MRI, I don't care what he does again in a workout. I don't care. That it's never been a question of talent with him. It's just the injury.
Right. Yeah. He's the best prospect if his back is fine. Yeah. I think he's by far the best. And I'm still hugely high on Andrew Wiggins. I think Jabari Parker is going to be fantastic. I'm more sold on Dante Exum and Julius Randle than I was in the past. Like, I think these guys are going to be great. But Joel Embiid, without a back injury, is the best prospect. Like, I think he's the best player. I think he's the best potential. Like, he's up there. But I don't know how, like, I think the reports out of these workouts are fantastic, but I'm with you. Like, until we know whether or not his back injury looks like it has long-term issues, like, I don't know how you feel comfortable with that. And that's not a knock on him. That's just knowing that back injuries suck, especially for big guys.
And you're measuring risk-reward, where you might just end up having to say, I'm willing to risk it because he is that much better, I think, than Andrew Wiggins and Jabari Parker.
Yeah, and I mean, if I'm the Cavs, assuming it, you know, you don't see like a fractured back the next time you do a test on him, you know, I would probably take him regardless, just for the risk reward of it. But I'm not saying that's a good idea. That's just I would throw that out there.
I think the Cavs are trading that pick. I think they're going to go for some sort of home run move. I'm not, and the thing is, I guess Kevin Love is really the only option. I'm trying to think of another star that they could legitimately trade the number one for.
And yeah, I don't know.
The list gets really tight, but trading it seems much more like a Dan Gilbert kind of thing than taking another number one. Although I love the idea of them just keeping it. I love the idea of basically saying, we tried to push this too hard. We're going to trade Varejão. We're going to take Embiid, and we're going to have Anthony Bennett, Joel Embiid, Tristan Thompson. We're going to have Deion Waiters and Kyrie Irving, and that's going to be our core.
See, I would trade Thompson, and I would keep Varejão. But I know that that's an injury risk. But I just think, like, if you're serious about winning now, not that Tristan Thompson's bad, but I would want the Embiid Varejão combo.
That's what kind of I'm saying though, is I would take more of the long term approach. I'd be like, let's not try and be a playoff team next year. Let's try and be an awesome team in 3 years. Because Tristan Thompson has improved every year, despite what Cavs fans will say. Like, he is better last year than he was the year before. Is the improvement has not been such that you're like, wow, he's a really great player. But I also don't really have any sort of I almost never have games where I watch Tristan Thompson and go, that guy sucks. Not a one. Like, it's just it's either he's not engaged enough or he needs to improve. It's not that guy is terrible.
Yeah, I definitely don't feel that way anymore. I don't know. I mean, the problem for me is I don't know that he is a definite starting big man in the league.
Yeah,
and that's not necessarily a knock. Like, I feel the same way about Jason Thompson, of where I don't know that I would definitely start him, but I know I would want him in my rotation.
And like Anderson Varejão at his peak was an all-star caliber guy.
But can you trust the injury? I mean, can you have two big men that are, you know,
right? But also, you know, Varejao's body type is different. So if you put Joel Embiid, a monster who's skilled, maybe that makes Tristan Thompson better. You know,
yeah. That's
and
true.
even if Thompson is your backup, and Anthony Bennett sheds some weight and gets himself right, and all of a sudden you've got a guy that can basically score from range, has some muscle, and then this massive dude inside. Like, that's – you still got a really great combination. Like, I guess I would say the odds are that one of Anthony Bennett and Tristan Thompson are going to turn into a quality starter. And as long as one of those guys turns into a quality starter next to Embiid, and if Embiid is what everyone thinks he's going to be and he's healthy, like, then you've got – plus, if you keep Varejão, now you've got injury risk and Embiid. You've got two injury risks down low. And if you happen to have both those guys go down, well, now you're in serious trouble.
Well, yeah, and I guess there's this thing. It's like, oh, we can't sell, you know, a rebuild or a non-playoff year to our fans anymore. And screw that. Show you have a plan. You can sell a plan.
Sixers fans are excited. Like, for as much as everyone is bitched constantly about the Sixers tanking, Sixers fans are more excited than I have ever seen them since I started covering the league. Well, they are legitimately thrilled at this idea.
Also, there's this idea of, like, oh, the Timberwolves have to get veteran players that can help them make the playoffs now because they can't sell a rebuild. You know, they've missed the playoffs for 10 years. They can't sell a rebuild. Can you sell an overpriced roster not making the playoffs again?
See, like, I think depending on what deal they make, I think that they can trade Love and get somebody that's going to basically put them in contention to make it next year.
There's not
and, like,
a chance.
Everyone flips out over this. Over when I say this, like, if you ask me, how much better is Kevin Love than Carlos Boozer? The answer is miles and eons and, like, vast distant light years. They're not even comparable. But I also think that there are times where you put together a team of veterans and just weird stuff happens. I've seen it.
Like, there's not a single deal that they can make right now that will get them into the playoffs next year. I'm telling you that. There's just not.
Mirotić, Boozer, Butler, and the picks?
Unless Mirotić is Dirk Nowitzki, no. It's just not. Like,
what if they get Adrian Payne, though, with that middle of the first rounder?
I would love that. The problem is they're still in the Western Conference.
That's true.
Yeah, that's the thing. They're 9 deep, ready to make the playoffs. Maybe 10 deep, but depending on what happens with the Pelicans.
That's the most annoying thing about the Kevin Love debate. That's the most annoying thing about this he hasn't made the playoffs thing. Like that's just absurd to sit here. Like, the Bobcats made the playoffs in the East this year, and I liked them. They were a fun team. But the Wolves were much better than the Bobcats.
Right. I mean, that's just part of the thing. It's like, you know what the lay of the land is. You know what you have to get to, so you build that team. And they failed to do that. But it's not an indictment on Kevin Love. It's that organization is incompetent.
I'm ready to shift the tiers and say that the top tier in this draft is now four deep, and it's Exum is number four, and there is a gap between him and the top three. But I could see someone reaching for Exum, but that there's a the gap used to be one, two, three, and then everybody else. Exum, I think, has moved into top four, and now there's a gap. And second thing, I firmly believe now, I really do think Noah Vonleh is going to get taken ahead of Julius Randle. I don't agree with it, but I think that's going to happen.
I'm very high on Noah Vonleh. I would probably – I don't think it's necessarily a smart decision to say you would take him over Julius Randle, but I wouldn't hate it. I just think he's going to be excellent. I think he's the modern big man.
He has a 7'4 wingspan and shoots threes.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I was talking to Sam Vicente, a really great writer for Fear of the Sword, who also does a ton of great draft work, and we were kind of arguing about Payne versus Vonleh. Payne's 4 years older, but he's a much better three-point shooter. And kind of the gap between those and whether or not, like, what would you take, like, the finished product versus, like, because the argument was, like, isn't Payne with Vonleh what you hope Vonleh becomes? I'm like, well, no, because in the NBA, your acceleration process is much higher. Like, you should be considerably better than any college player 4 years into the league.
Yeah, I would take Payne for the next 4 years. I would take Vonleh for the next eight.
Yeah. I think that he's going to have great shot-blocking instincts. I think that if he's put in the right situation, he's going to be able to run the floor well. There's a risk with the guys that are super gangly that kind of play on the outside that they'll drift. I think that he's got to – I mean, like with anybody, he's got to go in the right system. But there is a difference in grades, right? Like Julius Randle is going to go anywhere, and I don't see a situation in which Julius Randle isn't putting in eight a night. And that you can say, like, that's not good for a top five draft pick. That's absolutely right. That's still way better than some of the busts that we've seen throughout the year. Like, Julius Randle's bust factor is pretty low.
Yeah.
Vonleh's is higher, but his also ceiling is monstrous. Like, if he turns into a perimeter shooting, like, Mehmet Okur with a wingspan beyond all reason, well, now you've got something really special that you can use in the modern NBA, like you said.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think that, I mean, I just think, like, you know, I would probably rather my team take Randle and Aaron Gordon over Noah Vonleh, just because of I think their star potential is much higher. But if you told me, no, we're going to take Vonleh and we think he's going to be the better player for the next 10 years, I wouldn't think it's crazy.
Marcus Smart's got workouts in Orlando and L.A. this week. Now, they're going to do interviews with all the guys in the top 10, top 15 of this draft. It's not a massive deal. I can see a scenario in which Marcus Smart goes considerably higher than either you or I think that he should. I've actually got him six based almost solely on that principle, where I think that he goes higher than I think he should.
Yeah, I could. I mean, he's a very good player. Like, he's just like he's excellent skills. I'm not convinced he'll hit the three at the NBA level, but I think he's a player. Like, I think you have the potential to get a better Rodney Stuckey, which is a very good player. Rodney Stuckey's he can be a decent player at times. And if Marcus Smart is a more consistent Rodney Stuckey, that's a great pick. I don't know that I want that in my top 10, but, you know, I've really gone to this thing over the last few years of, like, as long as you are getting a good rotation player and not completely whiffing on these picks, you're doing a good job. And I think that you're still doing a good job if you take Marcus Smart, you know, maybe higher than you or I would take him.
You had Doug McDermott 15. Hadn't seen that before.
He's not even 6'7". I think his measurements, like, I think he'll have pretty good workouts. I think he's still a top 20 pick for sure, but
I know his vertical was considerably higher than expected.
Yeah, but he's not long, he's not tall, and he's not agile enough to be a three. I don't think. So I think he can be a good player, but I just think you're gonna get into these workouts, you're gonna see all these more athletic guys, and you know, GMs are gonna fall in love with that.
Yeah. Adrian Payne, I'm talking myself more into him being a top 10 guy.
I think he should be a lottery pick. I really do. I don't care that he's, you know, older than most of these guys. Like, I think he's a lottery pick. I don't think it's close.
I know they're very different, but let's say that you've got weaknesses at 3 and 4. James Young or Adrian Payne.
Oh, I'd take Payne. I wouldn't even think about it.
It's really, and Gordon's another one, because Gordon's measurements, like, I did a post on this morning. Jabari Parker did a workout and his measurements got leaked. So now he is as tall as Julius Randle, taller than Aaron Gordon, and has a wingspan comparable with both. Like, he's longer and taller than Aaron Gordon.
Yeah.
Which, like, that's, and the athleticism is the major difference. Like, Parker's just not as athletic. That's why he struggles so much defensively, because he just can't move.
Well, also, but, they put him at the five. Like, this is the thing about, oh, he doesn't play defense. They put him as a center. He's not going to play center in the NBA. He's just not. Like, I think he's going to be fine defensively. I don't think he's going to be good, but I think he's going to be fine. I don't think he's going to be a negative. And you put him in an NBA environment, and you get him a personal chef, and you get him a personal trainer. Like, that guy's going to shed pounds, and he's going to add explosiveness to it, to what he does. And I just, like, I think it's crazy to think that he's not going to be a top three pick, which some people don't.
I watched all of Nick Stauskas's offensive possessions the other night. Big night, Friday night for me. That guy is going to be a premier flopper in this league. He is going to be an incredible flopper in the NBA.
Oh, yeah. He can draw some fouls.
Like, everyone, yeah, and I said that, and, like, Blue Nation went nuts. Like, they thought I was insulting him. I was like, this is a good thing. Like, he's going to need that. Not like he's going to be blowing by a bunch of guys.
Yeah, he's like a he's like a likable Kevin Martin.
He doesn't have, like, an offensive set that makes you go, ooh. Like, he – but if he's able to draw fouls consistently, that's going to help his game a whole lot.
And he's just such a ridiculous shooter.
He is.
He's just so good.
But, yeah, he's going to be one of those, like, guys that shoots behind the screen, and I'm like, well, that can't possibly sustain itself. And I say that over a course of, like, 40 games and still find myself in the same thing.
8 years later, he's a career 39% three-point shooter.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and say that. I hate Jusuf Nurkić's game. Just, I hate every single thing about that guy's prospect. Just, if I'm going to be wrong, if I'm wrong on him, that's fine. Like, I'm wrong on lots of guys, but I do not understand how this guy is approaching top 10 stats on some of the boards.
Yeah, that's crazy. I think I'd take him no earlier than 20, but I would definitely take him. I think you can, yeah. I think you can mold him into a very good, very, very good big man, but he's not a guy where I look at him and I'm like, yeah, I'd consider him taking him 10, 11, 12, 13, any of those.
I love KJ McDaniels in every single way. I am hoping beyond hope he slips to 22.
If he gets a three-point shot, I'm in.
Like, and this is like a very typical me guy, because he ran the fastest sprint and had the 17th highest vertical at the combine. And so I was like, can jump, runs fast, long, athletic, yes! Like, I totally bought in, and that's a guy that has a kind of build or that kind of profile is often the guys that are like, well, that's great that he can run, he can jump. It'd be nice if he could do something else.
Right.
But I do like his handle, though. I like him. I've got LaVine higher. I like him a little bit more than LaVine, just because I feel like there's a lot of ways LaVine could go wrong at the next level.
Yeah, I think he's a more solid prospect. Like, I think if you're looking for a guy who can contribute now, you go with him.
I like that both you and I have TJ Warren at 19 to the Bulls, because it just makes so much sense. It hurts.
Once I saw, like, he measured with, what, like a 6'11 wingspan or something like that. Once I saw that, I was like, this guy is going to be a Tom Thibodeau player. Absolutely. Yes.
That works. Play Anthony early, 3, which I like a lot. Like, I like a lot as a prospect.
Yeah, I think he's gonna have excellent workouts, and I think his ability to stretch the floor, he's a very versatile player. Like, I just think guys are gonna, he's a guy you can plug in right away.
You got CJ Wilcox second round. I'm a little surprised at that. I figured Wilcox would be the guy you would love.
I do love him. I think you're gonna see a run on, you know, a run on guys with, you know, maybe higher potential or more specialized stuff. Like, he's more of just a scorer. I love his shot. I love his shot. But I think he's a guy that can slip, and then you start wondering, like, how the hell did this guy slip to the second round?
I am one of the few people that's still on the Roy Marble, the Devin Marble bagwagon. I love the guy's game. He is a lot of fun to watch. I don't care about his athleticism. I'm just like, take him as a role player, let him do his thing. Okay, I think that'll do it. So
that's what we got.
Yeah. Well, right. Enjoy game four.
I'll be there. I'll be there with bells on. Well, probably not bells on, but pants.
That'd be weird. Yeah. Follow him at Hawk Hoops.
Sure. Why not?
Why not? Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, thanks, Matt.